What are our motives for missions? Now let's start with wrong motives and false calls. Because of human depravity, even the best of us can do some of the finest ministry with mixed motives. Dr. David Livingstone wrote in his journals how he is deeply concerned that even when he was engaged in some of the greatest activities, he was concerned that his motives were mixed. You must not wait for your motives to be 100% pure before launching out on missions, or you will never get there. But once in the mission field, you can expect God to thoroughly purify your motives, for sure. Those who go into the mission field predominantly for wrong motives can cause a lot of grief to themselves and, of course, grief to those around them. Now, here are some examples of wrong reasons for involvement in missions. Number one, amazing how many people try to go into missions out of a desire to escape problems at home or problems at work, like they're not problems in a mission field. Boredom, job dissatisfaction, in-law problems can lead some people to want to escape to the mission field. But escaping to the mission field does not work because we tend to take our problems with us. Because the problem is, who's my biggest enemy? I am my own worst enemy. And if I can't get on with people at home, what makes you think I'm going to get on better with the mission team and the people of another culture and language in the field? Number two, some people go into missions out of a desire to impress other people. For example, missionary children sometimes feel obligated to follow in their parents' footsteps. There's fear of disappointing your college teacher, pastor, or church friends who are expecting you to go. So sometimes one goes out of peer pressure, and that's not healthy. A desire to be more holy and more dedicated than one's peers. This is what led many people to become monks and nuns and friars and abbots in the Middle Ages. They thought, if I really want to be serious about God, then I've got to go into the priesthood, or something like that. Well, some Protestants seem to think in a similar way, as though you can only be a dedicated Christian if you're in full-time Christian work, which is not true. One of the key principles of the Reformation is the priesthood of all believers. All believers have access to God, and all believers can pray to God, and all believers should be witnessing for God. So we do not believe in the preacherhood of all believers. We believe in the priesthood of all believers. Not that everyone's called to be a preacher, but everyone has the right to pray to God. You don't have to go to pastor, pray for me, as though his prayers are going to be more powerful, and that he's got access to God that I am denied through Christ. We don't have to pray through Mary, or the saints, or the apostles, or the clergy. So we must watch out that we are not trying to follow some kind of Roman Catholic Middle Ages idea of spirituality. You can really serve the Lord powerfully in business, in arts, in entertainment, in government, in education, in so many different areas of life. God's will is far more important than what people think of us. And those people that you're trying to please aren't going to be there in the field anyway, and it's going to seem very hollow and taste like sawdust after a while. Thirdly, some people go to the mission field out of a desire to prove something to themselves. But the mission field is not the place to go for an ego trip. Fourthly, there's a desire to earn favor with God, a salvation by works mentality. This is very much Roman Catholicism as well, that we have to work to earn our salvation. Fifthly, some people go in the mission field out of feelings of guilt and pity. We are living in an age of guilt manipulation. And many people feel guilty for being better off than the downtrodden masses who've been exploited and oppressed. Now, I've heard this kind of preaching in missions conferences. I've been to missions conferences for a long time. And I remember, how many Bibles do you have at home? There are people in the world that don't have a single page in the scriptures. Now, instead of being grateful for your Bibles and going out of a sense of gratitude to God, freely, freely receive, freely, freely give, you know, going out of gratitude to want to bless the nations, this attitude of, I've got to go because I've got hot water, electricity, clean pillowcase, had a good breakfast, and next thing you're feeling so bad for so many people who don't. No, that isn't a good reason to go to the field. We should be grateful for what God's given us, not guilty. And then we should serve out of obedience to the commands of God, because we see the need, because we love the Lord, because we're concerned for the people. There's many good motives, but those are wrong motives. To go for guilt and pity. Guilt and pity are the lashes of the devil. That is not the way that God motivates us to his work. Sixthly, there's emotionalism. I don't know if the church has ever had a more emotionalism dominated phase in its history. Today we're living in an age of existentialism. Everything is about me, myself, and I. And it's all about my emotions. Follow your heart. Wish upon a star. If it feels good, do it. Human emotions are God-given, and human emotions are essential. But emotion is not a good enough basis for a call. It's unlikely the Lord Jesus felt like being scourged and whipped and crucified that day. He went out of duty, out of love. He did not do it just because he felt like it. Okay, those are some wrong motives. So what is holding you back? Are you in debt? You must pay it off. People cannot go to the mission field in debt. Owe no man anything, the Apostle Paul told us. Many people that I know have gone into missions and have had to raise money to pay off their student loans, their debts. And so, no, that's not the right way to do it. You can't expect people to donate money for missions for you to use to pay off your debts. When I was convicted of the fact that I was in debts, I actually came back from the field. I actually had debts, and I worked at Newlands Cricket Ground, where my father was in charge of the Western Province Cricket Union. I worked at the cricket games until I had enough money to pay off the debts that I had, and then went back in. Now, there are different things you've got to do. Lenora, when she is wanting to come out to South Africa and join our mission, she sold her car to pay off her student loan. She realized that she couldn't go in the field with a debt. And so it is. Many people have different things holding back, but debt is a stumbling block. You cannot expect God's people to be supporting you to pay off your debts before you went into the field. Number two, are you getting too much education? A lot of people get too little, but some people overdo it. One of the greatest theologians of all time, if not the greatest theologian of all time, Dr. John Calvin, was a professional student. He loved study. And at age 27, he had already produced one of the greatest masterpieces of theology ever produced, the Institutes of the Christian Religion. He later revised it until it became even better, and better until it became the 1,000-page, 80-chapter Manifesto for the Reformation, Apology for the Faith, phenomenal catechism for believers. But John Calvin at 27 had no intention of going into the pastorate. He wanted to keep being a student all his life. And he was diverted by a local war to go through Geneva. He only planned to be in Geneva one night, and William Farrell, the fiery, red-headed, long-bearded debater who won whole cities to Christ with his fiery preaching and debating, he heard that John Calvin, this up-and-coming student, this theologian, this great writer, was passing through. He went to the hotel where he was staying, and he challenged him to help them disciple the people of Geneva who had just been won from Catholicism. And the more Farrell tried to persuade Calvin, the more Calvin was convinced he did not want this difficult job in this troubled city. And at one point, William Farrell stood up to his full height and thundered, "May God curse your studies if now, in an hour of need, you forsake Christ's church." And John Calvin said that the terror of God fell upon him, and he committed there and then to bow to the will of God and to become pastor in Geneva. He was willing to spend his whole life being a student. Some people love study, but of course, if we do study alongside our work, that's excellent. If study is an alternative to work for the Lord, well, then it's a stumbling block. Are you falling in love with someone who is not committed to missions? The amount of people you will hear that "I was called, I was going, but then I got married to a person who was not." Normally you would assume that if you are married to somebody who is called, then you are called. It's a one flesh partnership. The idea that, well, my husband's called to missions, but I'm not, is just wrong. Now, I must say, while I was in theological college, I met the girl of my dreams. She was everything I could have ever wanted. If I had a checklist, which I did not, she ticked all the boxes, and I was just ecstatic, and she was, and her parents were, and my parents were. We were all thrilled and engaged, and I was heading for marriage, and then she started to try and persuade me to enter the pastorate. Her father was the head of a denomination. It was a very nice, cozy pastorate in Port Elizabeth. It came with two cars, big house. I could still go on missions for a couple of weeks each year, but there's income, there's medical aid, there's all the stability, and I had to make a choice. And I must say, my heart was torn. For the first time, I understood what the Lord said, unless you hate all those that you would love in comparison to your love for the Lord. You cannot be my disciple. I had to choose between what I thought was the best and my calling, and I knew my calling came first. And because I was not willing to change my absolute determination to be on cross-border missions, I lost my fiance, and I was devastated. But it was the right thing. And as it so happens, we're still friends today, and my wife's friends with hers, and my daughter's friends with her daughters, and we don't have to cross the street and climb a drain pipe to avoid one another. I wasn't the right person for her, she wasn't the right person for me, even though we were both convinced at the time. She had a different calling, I have a different calling. You cannot marry someone who is not committed to your call. If your call is missions, if you marry someone who's not, you're in trouble. Now, you can be like William Carey, who was a mega genius brain, who married somebody who is illiterate, and when she went, she couldn't even sign her name in the marriage register. The first Mrs. Carey signed with an X. She couldn't even write her name. And when they went to field, she went insane. She could not handle the stress. She would have probably managed fine in England. But the pressures of Indian spiritual warfare, she literally went insane there. And William Carey endured 12 years of hell, having a screaming, insane wife wanting to attack him with a knife regularly. And you could say William Carey did not marry well. Now, by his persistence, he survived, but that must have been a terrible drain. John Wesley married the worst possible, and George Whitfield didn't marry very well either. Their wives didn't help them. Their wives actually were a curse and a ball and chain. And when John Wesley's wife left him, he said, "I did not send her away. I will not call her back." And but the insanity of how John Wesley went about his wedding ideas was, the person he really wanted to marry, his brother sabotaged it. And George Whitfield had to intervene to get these brothers to talk to one another again. And then in the end, he drew lots over who to marry, which has got to be the worst way ever devised. And he married someone who he had nothing in common with. And John Wesley's marriage would not be an example for anything except what not to do. So who you marry is the second most important decision in your life after deciding for Christ, which I know when we look at it, we think we choose him, but later we discover he chose us. But speaking on a human responsibility point of view, who you marry affects an enormous amount of what you're going to become and where you're going to end up and how fixed you're going to be in the field. So marrying the wrong person can be catastrophic. And if it doesn't derail you of your ministry, it'll at least make it miserable. And if you want to read unedifying examples of how bad marriages can upset your ministry, read John Wesley's marriage, which is, it's just pitiful. You just wonder how a man who could be so intelligent in ministry could be so stupid when it comes to his marriage decisions. Fourthly, are your parents opposed to your going? Interestingly enough, I was up in the University of Minnesota, and there was a young girl who was coming to join our mission. She was keen, her church was keen, and I was there as a guest speaker, and we were having a sending off. They were commissioning her as a missionary to come and join Frontline Fellowship. And at the service, there was two rows of her parents and uncles and aunts and friends and relatives, brothers and so on. And after the pastor had made the different preliminary comments, and he's about to commission her, and he turned and he said, "Would Victoria's family please stand to show their support of Victoria going to field?" And there's this loud shout from them, one another, "We don't support her going to the mission field at all." I mean, the whole family was rock solid against it. I felt there was something wrong about their demeanor, but at that point I knew why. And the pastor there and then, he turned to me, and I agreed, and he turned and said, "Well, then we will not commission Victoria to go to the field. If her family is not fully with her, then let us go back to discussion phase. This is obviously not the right time." And Victoria was devastated, and she stood up. How do you like this for a quote? And she quoted the verse, unless you hate your father and mother and brothers and sisters, you cannot be my discipleship brother. And so she needs a bit more discipleship too. So we held off. She did end up in the field a few months later with the support of her parents and some of her relatives. But they were so shocked to see that the church and the mission withdrew the call when they saw there was such rock-solid opposition to the family. We wanted to negotiate with them, to discuss with them, and to see, but they were convinced that Victoria was hard-headed and she'd just do what she wanted. She didn't really want their blessing, which is actually true. So we had to counsel her to seek her parents' blessing, and we had to counsel them in the light of her attitude. And it certainly helped when they could see that the church, the mission, and later Victoria really wanted their blessing. That meant a lot. However, having said that, there are times where we're just plowing ahead pigheadedly and we're not communicating well enough. The blessing of your family and your congregation is very important. But there are times when you've got manipulative parents. I can mention some people who've been here whose mother would manufacture illnesses, imminent deaths of the father and so on, all lies regularly to try and persuade their daughter to come back to America. Very manipulative, lots of absolutely hideous things. I mean, total lies to just continually distract and pull her back. In this sense, we are not better off for our communication systems today. At least in the past, when people went to the field, they were in the field. And months later, they might get a letter. But today, you can be harassed on a daily basis by people through technology. So, if you're over 21, if you're not living in your parents' house, if they're not paying all your bills, you don't have to obey your parents, but you do need to honor them. My parents never really supported my going into the mission field. I was regularly harassed by my parents on, when are you going to get a job? I do have a job. I mean a real job. It is a real job. I mean earn a living. But I am earning a living. You are? Well, I'm not always getting paid it, but I earn it. No, I mean work for a boss. I do work for a boss. Who? God. No, but I mean a real boss. Well, God is real. Now, when are you going to stop wasting your life? Do something useful. And my parents were very negative about it. Well, I turned down several bursaries and good job prospects, and I plowed ahead with missions. And they couldn't see anything at first. They got more impressed when they saw me go to theological college and do well there. And they were there at the graduation service and impressed with how the college gave me awards and so on. And they start to feel, well, maybe it's not so bad, because they were very concerned for worldly accreditation. But nevertheless, it was only once my parents got converted that they were really supportive. Now, I couldn't allow unconverted parents to keep me from the field. I had to honor them, but you still must make a choice. If you're living in your parents' home, you must obey everything they say, for sure. They're paying the bills, you're under their roof. If you are an adult now and you're paying your own way, for you to decide, well, I know God has called me, I really want your blessings, but I must go even if you withhold it. Well, that's the call I made. Number five, are you worried about your safety? You should be, because you can lose everything you have going into the field. Everything. You must not take anything to the field you're not willing to lose, and that includes your own life. There are dangers. There's disease, there's sickness, there's injuries, there's crime, there's violence, there's wars. But then again, there are people who play things safely, and there are people who live dangerously. The same year that I was called up and entered the South African Infantry, there was a young man, same age as me, whose parents didn't want him to get a military call-up, because then he would have been in danger of going to the border, perhaps, and getting involved in some conflict. He might have died in the war there. And so they moved to the Carolinas in America. And before their son reached 18, because you can drive at age 16 in America, he had killed himself driving drunk on a Friday night back from a party, wrapped himself around the lamppost. So he chose to live safely. He chose to avoid danger, and he killed himself in a meaningless accident in America before he reached 18. I have not exactly played it safe, and I'm 55, and I've been through ambushes and aerial bombardments and imprisonments, and have accumulated more death threats than most people have letters in their name. So it's not about living safely. I like what Stonewall Jackson said, you are as safe in bed as you are in battle. As a Christian who believes in the sovereignty of God, in fact, I'd say you are safer in battle, in the sense of God's will, than you are in bed outside of God's will. Are you afraid of failing? Now, this is a big one. This is where most people actually give up. They're afraid of failing. We'll look at that a bit more just now. Number 7, are you afraid of dirt, disease, and discomfort? And you should be, because most mission fields have a lot of dirt, disease, and discomfort, which is why we do some of the things we do in our Great Commission courses. To a person says, I can't step into the river in my clothes. Yes, you can. I can't walk in the dark without a torch and a bush. Yes, you can. But I might walk through a cobweb. That is true. But that doesn't have to stop us. And so to get us out of a comfort zone, to get us into realize you can do more than you think you can do. Are you worried about your children? Now, many people are terrified about their children. But to be honest, I would be more concerned about my children being brought up in materialistic, highly secularized societies like Europe and America. My wife was brought up in one of the most beautiful cities in the world, Salzburg, Austria. And she says, and she loves Austria, loves skiing, loves the Alps, she says she would not want to have to bring up her children in Europe, in a secular, godless, materialistic society like Austria. Beautiful as it is, and safe as it seems to be, or used to be. If you're worried about your children will actually do better in the mission field than they will in most of our cities. What is the greatest hindrance to missionary work? The greatest hindrance to missionary work is self. Self that refuses to sacrifice, self that refuses to give, self that refuses to go. Therefore the Lord Jesus says, go ye therefore. So why do many resist the call to missions? Number one, the myth of the super spiritual mission. Unrealistic estimations of the spiritual qualifications required lead many people not to think of missions, because I'm not a super spiritual mega saint like David Livingstone or Mary Slessor. I couldn't do that. But if you actually read their lives, you'll find they were actually ordinary people whom God used in extraordinary ways, because they were extraordinarily dedicated. It's not that they were super spiritual. They had flaws, they had weaknesses, they had fears and doubts. Missionaries are ordinary Christians who face the same struggles and infirmities as other Christians, but they're responding to the Great Commission. Many people don't want to be involved in missions because of the burden of deputation. That's the second reason why many resist the call to missions. Promoting missions is hard work. Recruiting prayer supporters. Maybe the person feels embarrassed. Maybe they're introvert. They don't want to reach out and ask, would you be an intercessor for me? Would you covenant to pray for me weekly? Getting your home church involved, that's daunting. We don't get many Acts 13 churches today where the elders are fasting and praying and hearing from the Lord, and send out two of your best members, Barnabas and Saul, send them into the mission field. No, today the average church leadership have the gift of criticism and the ministry of discouragement. You're not the right person to go. This isn't the right time. That's not the right way. And so on and so forth. They do everything they can to deviate you. It's a rare church that actually supports, encourages, and sends one out. We had a tremendous blessing just 3 weeks ago when John Clifford's church undertook a special Sunday morning ordination service for John Clifford, who's completed his training and who's been 7 years in our mission, who's graduated with highest grade point average from Global Theological Seminary this last year. And they, along with our mission, had a joint service for ordaining John Clifford. Now, that's rare that you get a church that's actually willing to support you, acknowledge, encourage, we behind you. That's rare. That's great. I had a pastor who was supportive of me when I was converted, Reverend Doc Watson, and he became chairman of the board of our mission for the first 16 years. That is a phenomenal blessing. But let me tell you, it is rare. Most churches will probably do more to discourage you from getting involved than actually support you. But if you've got a church that actually will support you, can praise God. A church behind you and your family behind you, you can't be beaten. I mean, then you're really doing well. But most missionaries will not have that. It is a burden, But it's essential. We need to promote missions. We need to recruit prayer supports. We need to inspire others to get into missions. And this leads to the fact that you've got to write some prayer letters. Well, if you can't communicate to your prayer supporters, how are you going to communicate to people who are resistant to the gospel? If I cannot win a couple of prayer supporters, how am I going to win converts to Christ? Thirdly, there's the reluctance to make a long-term, lifetime commitment. We are living in an existential age, this now generation, all about me, my personal peace and affluence, my experiences now. Everything about existentialism militates against long-term commitment. But the most efficient expenditure of resources is long-term career commitment. If you think of the cost of getting to the field and the cost of training, well, of course, the longer they can be out and doing this work, the better. Patrick Johnson points out, and we've had him lecturing here, the author of Operation World, Patrick Johnson points out that you become really effective after about 4 years, and you reach your optimum efficiency at about 7 years. Yet most people have given up before they've gone a couple of weeks, forget about a couple of months. And the problem is, many people, the vast majority of missionaries, don't continue past 4 years. The vast, vast majority. I mean, many haven't even gone as far as a few months. But if they would just persevere, every month and year you're learning more, you're becoming more effective, you adapt, getting more skills, you understand the culture more. And so it's a great pity if people give up just when they're becoming really efficient. And one of the frustrations in any mission, including ours, is how often you invest so much time and effort, resources, training into people, and just when they're really getting to know their job and becoming effective, they give up and go away. And today the mentality is, I've been there, I've got the t-shirt. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt. That's where it goes. Which is really a curse of our age. Okay, you've been there, you've done that, and you've got the t-shirt. But how much have you been able to invest? And it's so important that we're willing to go the full distance. We need to be committed for life. Chairman of the Board of Frontline Fellowship, my father-in-law, Reverend Bill Bathlin, he's 88 years old. He's been involved in ministry for over 65 years, full-time, including behind the Iron Curtain, smuggling Bibles during the height of the Cold War, ministered in 110 countries of the world. He isn't retiring here. This picture, he was celebrating 50 years in ministry, and so we took him up to Sudan. Flew him up to Sudan, drove around the battlefront, did a whole lot of ministry. When we got back, do you think that was enough? He bought a Land Cruiser because he saw we needed another vehicle up there. Bought a Land Cruiser with his own resources and drove it overland, filled to the gunnel with trailer, with materials we wanted. Africa overland, 5,000 miles, 8,000 kilometers to Sudan to donate the vehicle there. Africa overland at 71. Not bad. We need to be committed for life to do God's will, and we need to be flexible as to where and how God may direct us to accomplish it. Fourth reason why people resist missions is the reticence to learn another language. Most of us have had bad experiences in school trying to learn another language. Language classes in school is normally one of the least favorite. But while this may discourage people from attempting to learn to communicate the gospel in the field through a foreign language, yet there's many mission fields where English is needed. 26 countries in Africa, English is the official language. In Nigeria, English is the official language. In Ghana, English is the official language. In Gambia, English is the official language. So many countries in Africa, English is the language. So you can go to mission fields speaking English, and then there's 21 countries in Africa where French is the official language. 5 countries in Africa, Portuguese is the official language. So there are just 3 European languages which are understood by most of the people in Africa. You don't need to learn another language to be effective in much of missions. And learning a language in a field while communicating the gospel is a far more enjoyable and workable experience. Why go to a language class over here in Cape Town to learn Arabic when you could go to Cairo University and learn to speak Arabic in an Arabic-speaking culture in Arabic University? If you want to learn Arabic, go and learn an Arabic country. Then you can be doing ministry while you're learning and while you're acquiring it. We've got a very limited way of going about language learning often. And when you're in the field learning with the people appreciate the strains you're going through, and they're helping you to learn it. And they'll value your language acquisition more than if you arrived in the field fluent in it, assuming that was possible. So it doesn't have to be as much of a strain as it seems. Fifthly, many people resist the call to missions because of the fear of failure. They are afraid they will fail to raise enough support. They'll fail to adjust to the new culture, fail to learn the new language. And the fear of tough, demanding, dangerous, or difficult jobs in unfamiliar surroundings scare many off. There's the fear of the unknown. It's one thing we're trying to do is take away the unknown. So that if we have a better understanding of what is there, if we face our fears, it's easy to overcome. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but a power of love and of a sound mind. Launching out in obedience and faith, nothing ventured, nothing gained. Now, there's a brilliant example in the Bible of failure that was not final. John Mark failed and deserted Paul. John Mark was identified as the man who'd been carrying the jar when the two disciples were sent to prepare a place for the celebration of the Passover. John Mark was the young man who on the night that the Lord was betrayed and arrested was following Jesus wearing a linen garment, and when they seized him he fled naked, leaving his garment behind. John Mark accompanied the Apostle Peter on his missionary outreaches in Jerusalem and Judea. It was in his mother's home that the church met for prayer when the Apostle Peter was in prison. When his uncle Barnabas and Paul returned from Jerusalem, they brought John Mark with them to Antioch. When the Apostle Paul and Barnabas were sent off on that first great missionary journey by the church at Antioch, John Mark went with them. What a privilege to be part of the first great missionary journey of the church. After a successful outreach in Cyprus, they traveled to Perga in Pamphylia, where John Mark left them to return to Jerusalem. The scriptures do not mention his reasons. Whether it was the dangers, or homesickness, or whether zeal had ebbed, or his courage had failed him, but Mark deserted the elderly Barnabas and the sickly Paul, leaving them to scale the mountain passes to the Pisidian Antioch by themselves. When Paul and Barnabas set off on their second missionary journey, Barnabas wanted to take John, also called Mark, with him. But Paul did not think it wise to take him because he had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not continued with them in the work. He was a quitter. I've got this rock here. Winners never quit, quitters never win. That's a philosophy in the army, in business. You don't accept quitters. They had such a sharp disagreement, they parted company. Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas. First missionary organization, first missionary split. Happily, that is not the last we hear of John Mark. Despite this unpromising beginning to his missionary career, John Mark came back and he was later reconciled to Paul. He proved himself in the fields, and in later years he became a faithful co-worker with Paul. And we read in Colossians 4 verse 10, "My fellow prisoner, Archippus, sends you greetings, as does Mark, the cousin of Barnabas. You have received instructions about him. If he comes to you, welcome him. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, because he is helpful to me in my ministry." Helpful to me. Well, that's quite an improvement. From initially being a quitter, a deserter, a failure, a man who put his hand to the plow and looked back and gone backwards, causing a sharp disagreement and division between his cousin Barnabas and the Apostle Paul, John Mark had gone on to repent, to restore, to make restitution, and to rebuild Paul's trust in him. So much so that Paul, in his pastoral letter to Timothy, describes Mark as helpful to me in my ministry. And Paul also mentions Mark as one of his co-workers in his letter to Philemon. But there's a general lack of direction, commitment, a paralyzing passivity and inertia. So the Lord commands us, look at the fields. Commitment and obedience to God will open up God's blessings. So why are many who respond to the call sidetracked? Love and marriage. Many prospective missionaries get sidetracked by marrying someone who's not willing to be a missionary. Parental opposition. The tension between honoring our parents and obeying the Lord keeps many from the mission field. Financial debts. Good intentions crippled by unwise choices and enslaving debts. I've heard some people really give some bad advice on finances. we had a speaker at one of our earliest camps, now I'm going way back in the 80s, who said, and remember 1980s money, a rand went a lot further. 1 rand bought about what, 100 rand buys now. He said, you need at least $10,000 or you can't go up the field. You need a four-wheel drive vehicle, you need this and that, you can't. Well, I was wondering, how did Apostle Paul manage without a four-wheel drive vehicle? And he just carried on with all these things that you needed. And I've seen missionaries start off by buying a four-wheel drive vehicle on hire purchase, renting some air-conditioned, carpeted offices, publishing full-color newsletters for the first thing, and getting into such debt that next thing, the printer's not paid, they've left the place that they were renting from without paying for the last few months' rent. And what a shocking witness. That is not faith, that is presumption. It's what we were dealing with on Sunday morning in the Bible study. But Christ must come first. So, those are the wrong motives. In the next session, we'll look at biblical motives for missions. Any questions or comments on this first lecture on motives and calls? Yes.
Yeah. How would you have counseled William Carey coming to you saying, I know I'm called for missions, but my wife, she doesn't want to go. She's really reluctant. She might, you know, go insane.
Well, we know what we would counsel. We would have tended to counsel that you can't do it. I mean, he's married wrong, meant to be a team. But when you look at church history, you can see God uses flawed, failed, broken people, because we wouldn't have chosen William Carey, probably. He doesn't have enough education. He hasn't finished primary school, never went to high school. His wife is illiterate, a simple person, to put it nicely. There's a fragile person, it turned out, Dorothy Carey. So, from our perspective, we might have advised against, and yet God used William Carey, in spite of all that, phenomenally. So, yes, if you ask me how would I have counseled, I can immediately see I would have counseled against what evidently was God's will.
But
our wisdom is apparently not very good.
To change the situation, was there something that you think could have been done in this situation to help the family?
Yes.
Maybe wait a little, educated.
Well, that's part of it, but I don't know if you know, but William Carey left for the field without his wife, against his wife's strenuous opposition. He determined to forsake everything, and when she wasn't willing to go to the field, he left without it. And their ship was caught in a storm and forced to return to port. And during that time, Dr. Thomas talked Dorothy Carey into going with William Carey, and so she joined him on his second attempt. They hadn't gone very far. They hadn't gone too much past the shores of England. The storm just prevented them from going. And so it must have looked like a wonderful answer to prayer. This is great. Dorothy is now with. But in fact, it would have been better if she wasn't. Better for her, better for him. And again, that's going to trouble a lot of people, the idea that this man was willing to go to field without his wife. But then you get another troubling example of C.T. Studd. C.T. Studd's wife, while she went with him on his first two missionary journeys, China and India, when he went to Africa, she was too ill. Well, doctor said he was too, to make it firm. But he went and he didn't see his wife for the next 14 years. And she ran a mission back at home. He apparently went with her support, mind you. She held the ropes on the other side. So these can really shatter folks in the family orientated views of things. But again, remember the limited travel, the limited communications. People had to make sacrifice and go into these inhospitable, long away places in order to fulfill the Great Commission. So, Carey and C.T. Studd seemed to know, well, C.T. Studd's wife was a brilliant woman. There's nothing wrong with her. She was intelligent. She was daughter of missionaries. Her parents were Salvation Army missionaries to China. She was top class, hard-working, and all this, but all the same, to think of a man leaving a fairly infirm wife behind for the last 14 years of her life does seem deeply disturbing. But there's no question that God used C.T. Studd and William Carey enormously. So how are we to deal with it? Alan, do you have any answer on this? more intelligent than what I could say?
No, those are the two examples I immediately thought of, C.T. Studd and Carey. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, if I'd been on the mission board, I would probably not allow Carey to go. And looking back, though, you see God's hand of blessing. I believe Carey's first wife died and then he remarried, if I'm not mistaken.
We've got a book, The Three Mrs. Careys, because his second wife was a brilliant, intelligent, he had learned his lessons the first time. After his first wife died, he married this really intelligent Danish noblewoman who was a brilliant asset to his ministry and revolutionized it. Sadly, she died of illness after, I think they had about, 10 or 11 years of very happy marriage. So, yes, but William Carey actually married three times. He outlasted two of his wives.
One interesting thing about Whitfield, you mentioned him earlier, I don't think they really understood courtship too well back then. He was courting this woman, but then one of his associate evangelists was talking with this guy one day. He says, I think you need her more than I do. Here, you marry her. Like she had no say-so whatsoever.
He was probably thinking he's being unselfish.
Yeah.
Denying the flesh, being self-disciplined.
Right.
It is very but again, Whitfield came from the Holy Club where they had that mentality of complete self-denial.
And I think it was Wesley also, when he got married, he says, now I want you to know, speaking of his wife, I have no intention at all of changing my travel schedule.
Yeah, he really knew the way to someone's heart.
Yeah. There's another interesting thing about him, which is really remarkable. If you look at how much money he generated, Wesley, from the sale of his books, all the income, if you were to translate that from the British pound of 1770 to U.S. dollars today, he was bringing in $2 million a year. And he lived on $63,000. He gave it all away every year. All that money, year after year. And I'm sure that didn't sit well for her either. She had to live in relative poverty,
Yes, I might have caused more questions than we've answered, but that's also part of it, that we think about these things. So, any other responses, questions, comments?
From my side, with the churches I've been to in my life, there was no real teaching on missions. We'd have the odd missionary picture, show some sad pictures, ask them for money, and maybe ask the priest going to the mission field. There was never really training to get an idea what it really happens, what it costs to do.
Yes, it's important to count the cost, for sure. It's extraordinary how much God has accomplished with the sometimes questionable characters available. There's no perfect missionary. There are some incredibly inspiring examples, obviously, and that's what we focus on, like victorious Christians who changed the world, various ancient missions. But all of them had problems and challenges which we would not want to face. And some of them made some pretty unwise choices, especially when it comes to marriage, as we've mentioned. So we can learn from them, though. We can learn how to be wiser on those areas. We all have weak spots. We all have blind spots, which is why we need counsel. And we need to learn from the examples in history, examples in the Bible, and from examples of contemporary people as well, which is why it's also important to get counsel. There are some missionaries I know who have crashed and burned because they don't ask for counsel. They will not ask for advice. They go ahead. I mean, we've had people we just got married. No seeking of counsel. We've bought a farm, bought a house, we're moving church. No seeking counsel beforehand, just making a decision, which can have enormous repercussions. If we don't seek counsel, it is pride, it is arrogance, it is foolishness. We're just destroying ourselves. Other people have been this path. And I must say, one of the best decisions that I made was when I determined to obey the counsel of my pastor. I was a difficult, rebellious member of Highlands Baptist Church, frustrated with them. They weren't good enough. This isn't Book of Acts Christianity. It's hypocritical. And then the Lord convicted me of my wicked, sinful hypocrisy. That verse that we read in Hebrews 13 about obey those who rule over you. And I saw this and I went to my pastor and I repented and confessed and committed. And one of the first things he said to me was, you need to go to theological college and get the theological training. The last thing I want to do. I don't need that, and what can I learn from them anyway? And the Lord's coming back soon. I had every reason why I shouldn't do it. But because I'd made the commitment, I went ahead and did what he wanted. And I enjoyed it, actually. I was amazed. Goodness me, there was so much that I learned from them. I had no idea that would have been beneficial to me, and yet was critical. And my pastor made several key instructions and changes and rebuked, and many a time it was a hard pill to swallow. My first, second, third reaction would be to say, no, but I went ahead with it because, well, he is my elder, my superior, he's the man God used to counsel, lead me to the Lord, and I will go ahead with it, well, I'm sure it's wrong, and later find he was right. But if I'd just gone on my youthful foolishness, I could have ruined my life and missed blessings galore. I must say, covenanting to listen to the counsel of my pastor was just phenomenal. And after that, I sought other mentors. And it just blessed my life, because often the counsel they give is not what I would have chosen or thought was right. Looking back now, it's so obvious that they were right, but at the time, it was a wrestle for me. The difference is, what did I know as a 20 and 21-year-old? My experience was limited. But these folks had been down that road, they'd been around the block so many times, they could see it so clearly. It's as though they were standing at the top of the mountain, they could see the whole thing, and they saw exactly where you fit in, and they could solve it. For example, you might get an electrician, you might get a plumber in about the problem, and they hear one or two things, do a couple of things, they've diagnosed the problem, and they've solved it just like this. How did you? Well, actually, there's no mystery for them. They know exactly how these things work, and they know exactly where things go. And a person who's been missions for years is bound to know more about how things work than a person who's just been saved. It's just extraordinary, though, how young people have this absolute conviction that they know best, and all the people of them are idiots, and what do they know? And I was one of those. I was also a foolish and self-opinionated new convert who's convinced that nobody was spiritual in church, none of them understood, none of them were committed to the Lord, really, and I felt it was me against all of them. And when I became a team member and just knuckled down and submitted, God led so many mentors in my life, and from Reverend Doc Watson as my pastor, who we had a long relationship all the way to his death. He guided the beginnings of our missions wonderfully. And he was also a chartered accountant. He'd come in once he had books, and he'd always find something wrong. I mean, he could just run his eyes over, and he could see if something didn't add up, and he tightened us in so many different ways. Francis Grimm of Hospital Christian Fellowship was an amazing mentor, strict and hard as it came, very helpful. Reverend Fitzhouse, my Old Testament professor at college, invaluable. Reverend Bill Bathman, Earl O'Stegan, God has led different people that I've had the privilege of mentoring from him. Herod Niels, going door-to-door Muslim evangelism in the Malay Quarter. What insights, how to win Muslims to Christ. And that really blessed me so much. And Voltika Schwantner, who now runs SAM Life Challenge Africa, ministering to Muslims. We had, for months, praying every Saturday morning for unreached people groups. And I felt exactly as Alan Baker mentioned, that the people who prayed with you are friends with for life. And there's such a strong bond to this day from those prayer meetings we had back in the 80s. And I was just, what a privilege to learn from people who've been further down the road than I have and who've got years more behind them. You save yourself so much grief. When, why should I always be bumping my toes, stubbing my toes, bumping my head, burning my fingers, when I can learn from other people and spare myself a whole lot of grief? But we have had foolish young men here who just always knew better and never would listen to counsel, would always charge on ahead with even life-changing decisions such as who to marry and how to get married and when and what, and just smashing relationships, destroying families, undermining ministries, so much so that, you know, imagine eloping and getting married secretly. Of course, the daughter's parents are going to be angry. And of course, you, why do it like that? But people who just won't listen to counsel, they just smash on ahead and they leave behind them a wake of destruction. So I trust some of these counsels will help. Any other comments or questions?
I've never been part of a mission organization that did physical training every morning. That's awesome.
Amen.
I've never seen that. It's great.
Well, we were inspired by Reverend David Fraser, who was a missionary to Moreland up in South Sudan, and they have taken the brunt of the persecution. But when he came straight after the First World War, he was converted in the Anglo-Boer War. He fought in the First World War. His wife was a nurse during the First World War in France. He fought in, against the Turks and the whole campaign in Ottoman Empire. And after the war, they came to Moreland, planted a church in Louis. He started every morning at 6 PT, but drilling PT. He had them marching. And these people are the most disciplined people in Sudan, the most hygienic, the most literate, the most intellectual. They run so much. I must say, you can just see, when you ask them how they all say, the missionary came here, Reverend Kenneth Fraser. He drilled us, he taught us. And yeah, it shows you discipline. It really helps, it makes a difference. Samuel, you had a comment.
I want to ask the missionary ministries, can you have a special administration? How can we link to sort out if there's any problem, like a person who is responsible for the mission, if it is facing some challenges?
You're talking about administrative things, you're talking about council?
Yeah, it's sort of like board members or something that they can give you advice or something like that.
Oh, every mission needs a wide range. We need the deacons, such as the ones who organize the practicalities of distribution of the aid to the widows and orphans, and you need the elders who will be guiding, leading, and teaching. So yes, there's the diaconal ministries, there's the eldership ministries, and every mission should have them. And we've got, here we would distinguish between missionaries, who are the elders, teachers, preachers, evangelists, and the staff, who are the deacons, the practical ones who handle the money, make things work, logistics and so on. And so just as Colin would be the manager of the mission, I'd be the director of the mission, and we've got, I don't interfere in the management because the deacons know better how to deacon than the missionaries do, and that's the way we work. And then we've got a board who people can turn to, and for example, Mrs. Scarborough, who would have met last night, she's one of our board members. She was London Missionary Society missionary to the Gilbert Islands. You know, real veteran, hard work, led the Women's World Day of Prayers, has led Gospel Defense League, her husband ran denomination, all kinds of great work. So we've got people like that. My father-in-law is chairman of the board, who's been involved for years and years. Dr. James Kennedy was one of the members of our board as well.